Dermatology Snapshots 2023, Paper 1. Facial erythema in patients with atopic dermatitis treated with dupilumab, a descriptive study of morphology and etiology. Journal of the European Academy of Dermatology and Venereology, Arne et al. Why we chose this paper. Facial erythema was described in the original phase 3 clinical trials of dupilumab, but it is seen and can be problematic. We're keen to know more about it and why it happens. Study aim and design. A multi-centre, prospective cohort study administered via patient survey and clinical evaluation of patients with atopic dermatitis on dupilumab from January to December 2020. What were the main findings? 162 patients with atopic dermatitis on dupilumab were surveyed and classified as follows. A. Pre-existing facial dermatitis prior to dupilumab therapy, 84.6%. Following dupilumab treatment, facial dermatitis improved in 88.3%, led to no change in 6.6%, and worsened in 4.3%, the exacerbation group. B. No pre-existing active facial dermatitis, 15.4%. New onset facial erythema after starting dupilumab in 24%, new onset group. Most of the exacerbation, 86%, and new onset groups, 67%, had a history of frequent and or prolonged facial topical corticosteroid use prior to commencing dupilumab. And clinical assessment often attributed the facial features to steroid withdrawal, followed by refractory or undertreated atopic dermatitis. Limitations. Is it applicable? Diagnosis of steroid withdrawal was mostly based on clinicians' assessment. What's the take-home message? Reassuringly, dupilumab-induced red face is relatively rare, and in fact dupilumab improves the majority of pre-existing facial dermatitis. A thorough history, including steroid use and where appropriate further investigations such as patch testing and or biopsy should be considered. Paper 2. The need for potassium monitoring in women on spironolactone for dermatologic conditions. Plant et al. Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Why we chose this paper. Spironolactone is used off-license to treat acne vulgaris, androgenic alopecia and hirsutism by blocking the action of androgens. While the risk of hyperkalemia in those under 45 years of age is considered negligible, studies in the over 45 years are very few and we're uncertain how often these patients should be monitored. Study aim and design. This study aimed to compare rates of hyperkalemia, potassium greater than 5.1, in females 45 years and under or over 45 years. It was a retrospective chart review at the Medical University of South Carolina between 2012 and 2020, N equals 195. Patients were excluded if they had other conditions such as congestive cardiac failure or chronic kidney disease. What were the main findings? The mean age under 45 years was 29.8 and the mean age over 45 was 57.5 years. The mean course duration was 27 months and the majority of patients were on 100 milligrams or less per day. The mean monitoring frequency was 1.24 per course per year. Three patients, 1.5%, developed mild hyperkalemia, potassium less than 5.8, related spironolactone. Two resolved without dose adjustment, and none were symptomatic. One patient was over 45 years old. Limitations, is it applicable? Only 73 patients, 36.1%, had both initial and monitoring labs, where a change from baseline could be identified. The population could be more diverse. 74.8% were under 45, 68.7% were white, and 90.6% were not on interacting medications. Confounding factors were not discussed for the two patients where hyperkalemia resolved without dose change, such as whether the samples could have been hemolyzed. This was also a retrospective study. What's the take-home message? This small study adds to the evidence that there's a low risk of significant hyperkalemia from spironolactone use in both younger and older patients with normal cardiac and renal function. Routine monitoring may not be needed or could be minimal, such as once per year. More data is needed in other populations where there could be higher risk. Paper 3. Tacrolimus, swish and spit for complex apoptosis. Outcomes in 21 patients. Herrin et al., Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Why we chose this paper? While we have some effective systemics for complex apoptosis such as dapsone, colchicine and thalidomide, topical treatments are limited and largely restricted to steroid preparations. Study aim and design. Tacrolimus, swish and spit has been used for lichen planus and geographic tongue, and this study sought to evaluate its use in complex apoptosis. Patients were advised to dissolve a 1 mg capsule of tacrolimus in 0.5 litres of water, swish for 2 minutes and spit twice daily. What were the main findings? Of 21 patients, mean age 43 years, 10 were using systemics concomitantly. 18 improved with tacrolimus swish and spit, 86%. 12 completely cleared, 3 had no response, and the remainder had a partial response. No side effects reported. 8 patients were able to stop or taper their systemic medication. No monitoring of bloods was necessary. Limitations. Is it applicable? This was a retrospective study with a small sample size. Several of the patients were on concomitant systemic treatment. What's the take-home message? This small study suggests benefit with tacrolimus swish and spit, and with capsules being easy to dissolve and this treatment avoiding steroids, we believe it will be increasingly used in several oral conditions, such as complex apoptosis. Paper 4. Increasing prevalence of anti-nuclear antibodies in the United States. Dintz et al., Arthritis Rheumatology. Why we chose this paper? It's believed that autoimmune diseases are increasing, but we're not sure if that's due to improved diagnosis. A positive ANA is a cause of many referrals and some undue anxiety, so it's important to know what the background ANA positivity rate is. Study aim and design. Data from the US National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey was used to estimate the prevalence of ANA over a 25-year span from 1988 to 2012. ANA in 13,519 persons aged over 12 was sampled from 3 National Health Nutrition Examination Survey time periods: 1988 to 1991, 4,727 persons; 1999 to 2004, 4,527 persons; and 2011 to 2012, 4,265 persons. What were the main findings? Overall population representative ANA prevalence estimates of 11%, 95% confidence interval, 9.7 to 12.6, in the 1988 to the 1991 group, 11.4, 95% confidence interval, 10.2 to 12.8, in 1999 to 2004, and 16.1, 95% confidence interval, 14.4 to 8, in the 2011 to 2012, for persons aged over 12 years. In the older age group, this went from 15.3 to 15.8 to 20.6. Although African Americans had higher odds of ANA, racial differences diminished over time. Obesity in the United States has increased, and results suggest a possible shifting of association between ANA prevalence and individuals who are overweight, from inverse associations in the first two time periods to a positive association in the third time period, where ANA prevalence also increased the most. No time trends in adults aged 20 to 49 years, but ANA prevalence increased over time in adults aged over 50 years. Limitations is applicable. 1. Associations were based on cross-sectional data rather than repeated measures. 2. Some variables were self-reported, including the limited questionnaire data on autoimmune diseases. 3. ANA was not assessed in children aged less than 12 years. 4. The US National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey excludes institutionalised participants, such as the elderly and in residential care. 5. The US population data may not be comparable to the United Kingdom. What's the take-home message? This study shows increasing prevalence of ANA in the US population from 1988 to 2012. We're not sure what the significance of this is, and if we would see similar changes in the United Kingdom, but it's important to be aware of this possible increase in prevalence rates. Paper 5. Cutaneous polyarteritis nodosa diagnosis and treatment, retrospective case series, Stewart et al., Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Why we chose this paper? There's very limited data on cutaneous polyarteritis nodosa. This case series may help in guiding diagnosis and management to some extent. Study aim and design. This was a retrospective notes review of patients with cutaneous polyarteritis nodosa in a single centre. What were the main findings? 16 patients were included, 15 were female. The average age at diagnosis was 44 years. All patients had involvement of the lower limbs, and half had involvement of the upper limbs. Subcutaneous nodules was the most common feature, seen in 93.8%. Just less than half had libido. 9 of 10 patients tested had negative MPO PR3. ANA was positive in 7 out of the 12 tested. The most common medication used was methotrexate, 68.8%, prednisolone, 68.8%, and azathioprine, 50%, and prednisolone. Most patients had a chronic relapsing course. Limitations. Is it applicable? This was a single-centre retrospective review, limited numbers. What's the take-home message? This case series highlighted several characteristics of importance. Almost all patients with cutaneous polyarteritis nodosa tested in this series had a negative anchor. Libido was present in less than half of patients, and subcutaneous nodules were present in almost all patients. Paper 6. Cutaneous manifestations of monogenetic autoinflammatory diseases, an international cohort study from the Juvenile Inflammatory Rheumatism Cohort, Montfort, Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Why we chose this paper? Autoinflammatory diseases are related to errors in the innate immune system. Syndromes are diverse and rare, but tend to cause fever, joint pain, rash, abdominal pain, and can cause amyloidosis. Cutaneous features are still being delineated. Study aim and design. This was an observational study to describe cutaneous manifestations in the four main monogenetic autoinflammatory diseases using the Juvenile Inflammatory Rheumatism Cohort of 779 patients. What were the main findings? Familial Mediterranean fever, N equals 633, 39% had cutaneous features. Most frequent was erysipelas-like erythema, specifically over the ankles. Oral apathy was the next most common and was mutually exclusive of erysipelas-like erythema. Cryopyrin-associated periodic syndrome, CAPS, N equals 68, 85% had cutaneous features. Urticaria was the most common presentation. TNF receptor-associated periodic syndrome, TRAPS, N equals 45, 53% had cutaneous features. Erysipelas-like erythema, most common, but was mainly reported on the upper arms or upper body. Periorbital edema, previously described as more common, was only seen in 9%. Mevalonate kinase deficiency, MKD, N equals 22, 73% had cutaneous features. Oral apathy was the most common, followed by maculopapular exanthems. Limitations is applicable. Diagnosis was based on diagnostic criteria, but by non-dermatologists, and genetic confirmation was not a prerequisite. It was done in approximately 70%. What's the take-home message? Cutaneous features in autoinflammatory disease, where present, are varied and non-specific, but larger cohorts such as this help us recognise subtle differences. Paper 7. Measuring atopic eczema control and itch intensity in clinical practice, a consensus statement from the Harmonising Outcome Measures for Eczema in Clinical Practice, Home CP Initiative, Leshman et al., JAMA Dermatology. Why we chose this paper? Home CP Initiative helps clinicians identify which instruments are best at measuring atopic eczema. Previously, POEM and PO SCORAD were recommended. Study aim and design. To identify the best tools for measuring eczema control and specifically itch intensity, via systematic review, the consensus meeting in October 2020. Consensus required less than 30% disagreement. What were the main findings? Recap of atopic dermatitis, and ADCT, atopic dermatitis control tool, recommended to measure eczema control. Both are easily available with permissions. For itch, three numerical rating scale, NRS itch intensity, were recommended. Peak 24 hours, which is a single item, and 1 week average and 1 week peak. Forms are freely available online via PROMISE, patient-related outcome measurement information system. Apparently they are well validated, easy and quick. Limitations. Is it applicable? With so many tools available, it's helpful to have some unbiased vetting to narrow down the options. Some clinicians feel that numerous forms detract from their clinical communication. Validation studies in children are lacking. What's the take-home message? Consider using a recommended tool to measure eczema control and itch to enhance your clinical assessment. Paper 8. Apremilast in recalcitrant cutaneous dermatomyositis, a non-randomised controlled trial, Beetham et al., JAMA Dermatology. Why we chose this paper? Cutaneous dermatomyositis significantly impacts upon patients' quality of life, but currently has no standardised treatment approach. Apremilast, a phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor, is used in the treatment of other skin conditions. Sporadic case reports suggest possible benefit in cutaneous dermatomyositis. Study aim and design. A phase 2A open-label, single-arm, non-randomised control trial at a single centre in the United States, evaluating the efficacy and safety of apremilast, 30 mg twice daily orally, as an add-on therapy in cutaneous dermatomyositis recalcitrant to adequate steroid plus or steroid-sparing drugs for a minimum of 3 months. Primary endpoint, overall response rate at 3 months. What were the main findings? 8 patients with moderate to severe dermatomyositis were enrolled in the study. At 3 months, all 7 patients achieved the primary endpoint. Overall response rate, 87.5%, with a mean severity, CDASI score, decrease of 12.9 after apremilast, p less than 0.001, equating to 56.7% reduction from baseline. D or QI also decreased. Apremilast was well tolerated, with no grade 3 to 4 adverse events. 2 patients were able to taper steroid use, and 1 was able to taper steroid-sparing agent usage. Limitations as applicable. This was a small sample, 7 females, 1 male, all Caucasian, and limits the generalisation of these results. Follow-up short. There was no control group or use of stable concomitant therapy restricts interpretation. Amgen, the manufacturer of the apremilast, funded the study. What's the take-home message? Despite the limitations, this trial introduces a potential new therapeutic option, suggesting that apremilast may be safe and effective in recalcitrant dermatomyositis. Larger clinical trials, ideally using apremilast monotherapy, would be helpful.